From BDWPS.com and BDWPS Podcasts, this is The Year of the Bowie, an 8-episode podcast series that tells the story of David Bowie. I'm your host, Andy, and I'll be taking you on this journey over the next 8 months. On this episode, you'll not only hear about Bowie's childhood, but also insight from those who were close to him. In today's episode, we'll be checking out some of Bowie's biggest influences and also some of Bowie's earliest recordings. As with all stories, we're going to start our journey at the beginning, specifically 9 a.m., January 8th, 1947. A baby boy was born at the home of Haywood Jones and Margaret Burns, located in the working-class town of Brixton. Upon seeing him, the midwife, known for her premonitions, said, "This child has been on this earth before." He was given the name David Robert Jones by his parents, who were unmarried at the time. David was their first child together, although they had both had children from past relationships. Soon after David's birth, the two got married. Of all his stepbrothers and sisters, his mother's son Terry would be David's closest confidant throughout his childhood and adolescence. Here's what Bowie collaborator Tony Visconti had to say about the importance of Terry on David's life.
Terry was a real big brother to David. He was a bright guy. They had a lovely symbiotic relationship. Terry was very much his best friend, and he loved him very much.
David definitely needed someone to turn to because he suffered from shyness and insecurity at a young age. In interviews, David has admitted that during his first day of preschool, he wet himself due to the overwhelming nature of it all. Through all these difficult times, though, Terry would be his rock and his hero. Despite the fact that David worshipped his brother, Terry was barely acknowledged by his parents. David often felt guilt for being the favorite child. One of David's earliest escapes was music. The first song that had an impact on his life was Danny Kaye's performance of the song Inchworm in the Hans Christian Andersen musical. The recorded version of the song would become little 5-year-old David Jones' favorite song, and the similarities to the song's unique chord progression, melody, and structure can be found in several of Bowie's songs over the years. He's even admitted so much himself. In an interview, he once said of the song Inchworm, "You wouldn't believe the amount of my songs that have sort of spun off that one song. There's a child's nursery rhyme element in it. It kept bringing me back to the feelings of those pure thoughts of sadness that you have as a child, and how you're so identified even when you're an adult. There's a connection that can be made between being a somewhat lost 5-year-old and feeling a little abandoned and having the same feeling when you're in your 20s, and it was that song that did it for me." Here's Danny Kaye singing Inchworm.
Thank you. inchworm, measuring the marigold. You and your arithmetic, you'll probably go far. Inchworm, measuring the marigold. Seems to me you'd stop and see how beautiful they are. To me you'd stop and see how beautiful they are. Seems to me.
Another art form David turned to as a child was the television. TV introduced young David to the concept of outer space, a motif that would be commonly visited in his music. Young boys in the 50s and 60s looked to astronauts as heroes because of their exploration of the unknown. But David was more drawn to the idea of escape. One of these shows that had an impact on David during that time was called The Quartermass Experiment. It was a serialized science fiction drama that promised viewers, quote, "There's a whole new world out there."
One morning, 2 hours after dawn, the first manned rocket in the history of the world takes off from the Taruma Range, Australia.
David's father also had an impact on his son's future in music. In fact, Haywood once worked in the music business as a manager for a former opera singing girlfriend. Both the singing career and the relationship were turned out to be failed endeavors. But when he saw his son's love of music, he chose to nurture it. At the age of 10, he brought home a copy of Little Richard's Tutti Frutti for his son. When David first listened to that album, he said in an interview, "My heart nearly burst with excitement. It filled the room with energy and color and outrageous defiance. I had heard God. Now I wanted to meet him." It's easy to see a connection between David's future image as Ziggy Stardust and the eccentric, flamboyant performances and androgynous appearance of Little Richard.
I wanted to be a white Little Richard at 8, or at least his sax player.
David's love of rock and roll would continue to grow, from Elvis Presley to Chuck Berry to Buddy Holly. The music gave the one-time shy boy confidence, and as he entered adolescence, he began styling his hair in a rock and roll style, adding rebellious touches to his school uniform. This rebellion also affected his schoolwork, and after failing his 11 plus tests, a precursory version of the SATs, his parents decided to enroll him in Bromley Tech in 1958 to hopefully get him back on track. They were wrong. David's favorite class at Brom Tech was art, a class coincidentally taught by Owen Frampton, the father of future rock star Peter Frampton. When asked about what he remembered about David, here's what Owen had to say.
His appearance was always a little bit out of the way from the point of view of normal school dress. His hair was always light and cut short.
It was in Owen Frampton's class that David met his rock and roll partner in crime, George Underwood.
David had already sort of prepared himself for fame, you know, even when I met him at 9, you know, he was kind of already going that direction.
The Terrible Twosome would spend their weekends at Furlong's record store, and eventually David took a job there. Underwood and Jones would also form a band named George and the Dragons with a rotating cast of classmates. For the band, David got a cheap guitar and began figuring out his way around the fretboard. He would also begin learning to play the saxophone, taking lessons from the highly respected baritone player Ronnie Ross. At the time, Ross was well known for his work with the band The Jazzmakers. In later years, Ross would be more well known for his performance on the Beatles' White Album, and more notably, Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side, a song David Bowie would coincidentally produce. Ross later said of the sessions he had with David, "I was teaching him about music in general, how scales were formed, about harmony, how to blow and breathe, and a little about how to read music. I told him that playing sax was like trying to get the sounds you hear in your head out through a horn and into a room. It wasn't just reproducing notes you saw on paper, it was creating a new language, communicating your visions without speaking them." During this exciting time in David's life, his brother Terry returned from military service. It was through Terry that David discovered the exciting jazz scene in London at that time. David said of that time, "I would go up to town every Saturday evening to listen to jazz at different clubs. It had a big impact on me." Terry would also introduce David to the literature of the beat poets. He became obsessed with the works of Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, and William S. Burroughs, and he clung to their shared message of freedom. All of these influences, the beats, jazz, James Dean, rock and roll, led to Bowie finding himself at the age of 14. Soon, the only things he cared about were music and sex. In an interview with Cameron Crowe in 1976, David claimed that he lost both his hetero and homosexual virginity that same year. But virginity wasn't the only thing he lost at age 14. That same year, David's sexual exploration led to a fist fight with his best friend, Underwood, who was pursuing the same girl.
My fist and his face made contact, should we say. Unfortunately, caused a bit of damage to his eye, and that was not the intention at all.
David was rushed to the hospital, where it was discovered that the sphincter muscles in his left eye were torn, preventing it from dilating. As a result, David would go through the rest of his life with one eye always dilated. But in a weird way, the injury added to his unique look. Mythology and legends often talk about the mystical powers that come with having a blighted eye. David himself would later thank Underwood for providing him with an even more magical appearance.
Later on, David said to me, "I did him a favor." So, I mean, a lot of people think it's quite an interesting thing to have two different colored eyes.
The injury to David's eye also marked a change in his focus on music. No longer did he see it as just a fun little hobby with friends. Rather, he viewed it as his future. Feeling his band, now called the Conrads, didn't see music as a serious venture, he quit, and Underwood soon followed suit. Around that same time, Beatlemania was taking the world by storm, and as a result, A&R men were signing any London band with the mod look and the northern accent. Seeing this as a time to capitalize on the opportunity, David changed his name to Davy Jones, and he started a band with Underwood named the King Bees. Fully motivated to take the music world by storm, David took the initiative to start sending letters to anyone who could help support his vision. One of these letters landed in the hands of washing machine mogul John Bloom, who enjoyed the cocky nature of David's letter, telling Bloom that he had the opportunity to back one of the most talented groups in the world. Bloom passed the letter on to his friend Leslie Kahn, who worked in the music business for years. When Kahn finally met the band for an audition, he was taken aback by David's confidence. Kahn said of the young singer, He had a total belief in his own talent, and he was amazingly arrogant. He said, "I'm the greatest. I don't give a fuck who knows it." He believed with a passion that he was going to be a big star, and I believed him. And so Khan signed them and cut the King Bees a deal with Decca Records. The first and only single recorded by the band, now called Davy Jones and the King Bees, would be the song Liza Jane. The song was met with a lukewarm response from critics and radio stations. To be frank, the song was a complete failure. Here's a taste of Liza Jane. The song's failure would also signal the end of the King Bees. Underwood decided to give up on music and become a graphic artist, while David continued searching for his big break. Here's what Underwood had to say about his friend's passion.
He said, "It's all right for you. You've got your art. For me, this is my life." I know what he meant. It's like sort of he'd committed himself and he's got to go. There's no turning back.
Khan stuck with David and set him up with another band he had been working with called the Manish Boys. Things seemed on the upswing with his new band, and soon after, Khan was able to get them booked as the support act for a tour with The Kinks, a band that was gaining fame off the heels of their song, Tired of Waiting for You. Kinks producer Shel Talmy was so impressed with the Manish Boys, he agreed to produce their first album. For the first single, Talmy chose Bobby Bland's 1961 R&B hit, I Pity the Fool, and the band recorded it in February of 1965. I'm going to play the single for you, and I want you to take special note of the guitar solo performed in the second verse, performed by a little studio musician named Jimmy Page. Here's the Manish Boys.
Well, I pity the fool. I said, I pity the fool. You know, I pity the fool. I said, I pity the fool. That falls in love with you and expects you to be true. I pity the fool. I said, I pity the fool. Ooh, I pity the fool. Let me tell you that I pity the fool. Cause she'll break your heart one day, and she'll laugh as she walks away. Well, I pity the fool. Standing there, watching you make a fool out of me. fool that falls in love with you. Hey, hey, I'm pitiful.
The band was scheduled to promote the single with an appearance on the BBC program Gadzooks. But when the producer saw the band's long hair, they asked them to get it trimmed before appearing on television. The band refused and was bumped from their appearance. Seeing this as an opportunity to make lemons into lemonade, Khan contacted local newspapers saying the band had been discriminated against due to the length of their hair. It was a brilliant publicity stunt, and soon after the band would appear on the news, performing a tongue-in-cheek interview about being mistreated.
It's all got to stop. They've had enough. The worms are turning. The rebellion of the long hairs is getting underway. They're tired of persecution. They're tired of taunts. They're tired of losing their jobs. They're tired of being sent home from college. They're tired of being sent home from school. They're tired even of being refused the dole. So with the nucleus of some of his friends, a 17-year-old, Davy Jones, has just founded the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Long-Haired Men. Well, here we are. Long-haired men, you've got to have your hair, what, 9 inches long before you can join?
Well, I think we're past that over now.
Have you?
Yes.
Now, exactly who's been cruel to you?
Well, I think we're all fairly tolerant, but for the last 2 years we've had comments like, darling, and can I carry a handbag thrown at us? I think it's just had to stop now.
The stunt landed the band a few gigs, but much like the King Bees, the Manish Boys' lack of a single led to an eventual breakup. David would quickly find another band to join, this time the Lower Third, a band that had a sound reminiscent of The Who. The band would only last a year together before parting ways. David would have one more failed attempt with a band called Buzz. Before deciding, he had to pursue his dream on his own terms. He realized he needed to go about it all differently, cut all ties, start with something new, something fresh. He would no longer have a band, no longer have Khan as his manager, and he would no longer be named Davy Jones. More about the birth of David Bowie on the next episode of The Year of the Bowie.